Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Adam Campbell, a permaculture practitioner and teacher at the Peace and Permaculture Center, located on 10 acres adjacent to the Stillwater Sanctuary in La Plata, Missouri. He calls the sanctuary his home, along with Ethan Hughes and the rest of their community. In this episode, we begin what is the first of several conversations that look at permaculture, philosophy, education, and what it means to learn in and live an authentic life. Along the way, we touch on many different models of thought and how we can accomplish these goals. As this is part one of several, and is taken from a longer single recording, the ending may come across as a bit abrupt. No worries, though. We'll pick things up again in the next release from this conversation. Expect that in the beginning of February. If you enjoyed this or any other interviews, please consider making a donation. Your goodwill helps to keep the show going and growing. Find out how by going to www.thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to the interview with Adam Campbell. I'll join you again afterwards with some thoughts and updates. If you're ready, Mr. Campbell, if you could give us a bit of your biography and background and how you came to be at the Possibility Alliance and what you're doing while you're there.
Well, sure. Thanks again, Scott. My name is Adam Campbell, and I'm a full-time member here at the Possibility Alliance and Stillwater Sanctuary, and I'm also the point person for an education center that we have called the Peace and Permaculture Center, so I'm kind of helping midwife or birth this gift to the world into reality. That's kind of how I would put it. And I've been here for about a year and a half now, and Stillwater Sanctuary has been in existence for 7 years, and the Peace and Permaculture Center has been going also for about a year and a half. How I came to be here kind of comes much before that. It's kind of the unfolding of my entire life story, which I'll be brief about. But I grew up in Branson, Missouri in the Ozarks in a very good family and safe area. And as I was going through my schooling, I began to realize that the story I was being told about our culture didn't make any sense to me personally. And I would put that as, you do well in junior high and you do well in high school so you can get into a good college, and you do good in college so you can get a good job, and you get a good job so you can make a lot of money so you can retire early so then you can finally do what you want to do before you die. That just seems silly to me, if not grotesque, because I thought, well, why not just do what we want to do now, knowing that if we bring our hearts fully alive into the world, it'll be of great service, and that we'll be taken care of along the way. And so I tried to find the alternative. Well, I just won't choose the mainstream. I'll do something else. But there wasn't really an alternative that I could find. And so that kind of began my searching. And as I began to search, especially once I went ahead and went to college, had a great time, and then got out into the world, and looking for this alternative way of being, I began to notice something else. And that was, I was running into a moral and spiritual crisis, which I can sum up simply as saying that, you know, the mystics of my life, the great religions, had, I felt, if I was going to sum it up really kind of bluntly and crassly, would be that you're just supposed to be a good person. There's a lot more to it than that, of course. And I realized in our hyper-connected and opaque world that it was impossible for me to know how to be a good person. I couldn't get any feedback. I didn't know where anything that I needed was coming from or the effects of any of my actions. It was my deepest desire to be a good person in the world. And I realized that as I began to understand the nature of things, I was complicit in all kinds of ecological destruction that was happening in the world by my good intentions. And that the system had been set up that way, which I didn't set up, but all of a sudden I was a part of. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to engage in the world in the way that I would call right livelihood, because I felt like I was completely ignorant to the effects of my actions. And maybe there's just one other thing to say about this, and this is kind of why I got into education, is because I graduated from college. I had a great time in my high school and college days. But after I graduated, I realized something, and that was that I didn't know how to do anything. I had 2 degrees in mathematics and English, and I love literature and I love math, but I realized that as far as meeting my own fundamental human needs in a way that I felt like I was responsible and capable, I was not capable at all. I was completely incapable. And not only that, but I was missing the experience of the world and the experience of myself in the world. My entire experience of learning up to that point had been mediated by some sort of expert at the front of the classroom who was disseminating information through a syllabus of some kind, and that actually, like, my own engagement in an authentic way with the world had been truncated or never even begun, really. So I decided I needed to go out into the world and explore and begin to see what it was like to be overwhelmed and in the unknown and to see what would come out from inside of me, which was actually, as I'm saying this now, I never thought about this before, but that was a very intuitive moment on my part, because now I've come to learn that education from the Latin root means to bring forth. And I had this sense that something was inside of me that needed to come out, and that could only happen through a real engagement with the things that were alive and happening around me, instead of, you know, fluorescent lights and a chalkboard and somebody talking and putting information into my head. And so that journey, I left, I decided to find the farthest place away that I could go to and just see what would happen. So I went on a solo backpacking trip around the world, and I started in Nepal and Tibet. And of course, there's a long story there, but what I discovered was that, this is going to sound funny to most of the listeners, I'm guessing, but I came from a very kind of naive and sheltered background, and I discovered the world was in trouble. I hadn't realized that yet. Most people today, I feel like, have a sense that, that's going on, but I graduated in 2000, and that was at the height of all of the bubbles, and everything seemed fine. And all of a sudden in Nepal and in Cambodia and in South Africa, everything wasn't fine. And I needed to find answers to the questions that I was getting hit with, like, why does poverty exist, and what's my relationship to it, and what's my responsibility to it? How am I complicit in it? And so after these travels, I came back and ended up going to a Catholic worker soup kitchen for 3 years to try and understand this question. What is poverty and why does it exist and how can I be a part of the solution to it? And after 3 years there, I realized that there was something that we weren't talking about. There was something we didn't have a language for. And the best way that I could put it was that there is this spiritual poverty, especially in the United States, since that's where I was. And this spiritual poverty was created by all of us with all of our little decisions every day. And that it manifested in one of the most concrete forms, and that we just threw people away, and that they ended up in the soup kitchen where I was working. And the only thing that I felt like that I could do to answer this conundrum that I was facing, which is, what do we do in the face of the spiritual poverty, was to say, if I could find out how to live my life in a way that was, you know, again, right livelihood, that was kind of opting out of this system of externalized costs, as they're called these days, if I could find a way of living well, and if I could model that and live into it, then it could become an alternative for other people who were in the situation that I was in, which was looking for something different that had meaning and value. And it was about that time that I discovered permaculture. At that point, I moved to Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I discovered permaculture and I was doing urban sustainability work and permaculture teaching and at the household and community level. And it was, I'm sure many people have had this experience, but it was like commonsensical culture. You know, it was like, why wasn't I taught this in third grade? This is all the stuff that I've been thinking about, disparate ways, you know, and here it is, a codified integrated design science that's been in existence for 30 years and I haven't heard about it yet. I was really upset and excited at the same time. And so that kind of began to move me into a path of, you know, working with it and doing with it. And finally, I got to the point where I was ready to start my own project. And for me, that meant everything that I've said to this point. That meant engaging as best as I could to be in whatever right livelihood meant with the world and with each other, and a radically simple project that was a witness to the world and a response to empire, and that was open and available for anyone who was attracted to it, for them to come and learn, and then to be able to go and start their own project. And I was ready to do that. And I wanted to do that in my home state. I grew up, I was born and raised in Missouri. I went to the University of Missouri for school, and I wanted to give back. You know, Wes Jackson says we need to major in homecoming, and we need to relearn that skill of dropping roots down and staying in a place, especially in this culture of utter transiency and placelessness. So I thought, well, here's what I'll do. At this point, I traveled around a lot, and I understood that if I could do two things at the same time, which is difficult to do, then I would find where I needed to go. And that thing was to move into the world with clarity and action, and to create a space for something bigger to come into my life at the same time. So to take action and to release control at the same time. I found different ways to do that in my life. And this way, in that moment, it looked like taking a bike trip, a completely unscheduled and unplanned bike trip around the state of Missouri. So I took 6 months. I started in Columbia, which is in the middle of the state where I still had some friends. And I just started talking to people. I had no plans. I just said, I'm interested in radical sustainability, food justice, permaculture, simplicity, you know, all of these things, and education, and where should I go? Who should I see? And I just kind of began to start making connections around the state with this intention, or this expectation maybe, that somewhere along the way, there would be this little sign on the side of the road that said, "Hey, Adam, here's where you're supposed to start your project. Come on in. The land's ready for you." And, well, you know, the story never quite met our expectations. I think Joseph Campbell said we never lived the life we'd imagined. What I did discover along the way was a lot of great people, a lot of great projects. And all of the projects I went to, I was like, well, I like that. I don't like that. I changed that. You know, I do this. Kind of that kind of assessment. But then when I showed up along the way to the Possibility Alliance, which I was directed to by some people, I took their 3-hour tour here, and it was a very humbling experience. I realized that they were, how do I put it, they were farther ahead on the ground than I was in my head. Like in my ideal scenario of what I would think that I could maybe pull off, they were already doing it better. Which was really disappointing, to be honest, because I was at that point where I was like, I was ready to make my own mistakes and start my own project, and I had to eat a little humble pie and to say, wow, maybe I just need to be a student for a little while longer. But the thing that happened, when I showed up and kind of was here for a week, they had 2 months previous just been gifted 10 acres of land to start this new kind of education project, which nobody really knew exactly what it was going to be yet, or they had just been kind of listening to the ether, so to speak, and kind of comments that people were making as they were coming through and conversations that were starting to happen about the modern educational model being obsolete. Like, it's finished. People haven't realized it yet. But to take on the amount of debt that people are taking on to get what they're getting out of a liberal arts undergraduate education is just simply not a worthwhile equation anymore, besides all of its detrimental effects, which we can get into later. And so we needed something new. We needed a new model that makes the old one obsolete. You know, as Buckminster Fuller said, if you really want to change something, don't fight against the existing reality. Create a new model that makes the old model obsolete. That's what we believe in here. That's been kind of guiding my life. And so they said to me, you know, they said, well, we just got this piece of land for this new educational center, and we're going to need somebody to take it on. And I was like, that's what I've been dreaming about for the past 15 years. And so I ended up coming back and doing an apprenticeship last year, and my role in the apprenticeship was to start this project, and now I'm back full time.
I feel like that's a whirlwind tour of your life in about, 10 minutes or so.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's quite a good bit. There are some things that you mentioned in there that remind me so much of my own life, and I don't know, I leaned away from my microphone so that I wasn't laughing directly into your ear at one point. But when you mentioned about permaculture being, what I think the term you said was like common sense culture.
Yeah, common sense culture.
When I was moving down this path more fully about 3 years ago, I gave my wife my copy of Gaia's Garden and David Holmgren's Permaculture. She read both of them, and then like one day she just throws them down on the counter and goes, "So why do you need these books to tell you this stuff? Like, why is this such a big deal for you? Isn't this just life? Isn't this just the way that you want to live?" And it was this kind of emotional smack from my wife about, well, I guess there are people who just naturally think this way, and she happens to be one of them, but
yeah.
I'm not. So, you know, for me, this was so radical, and for her, it was just kind of normal everyday living.
Yeah, and I can't tell if I feel really soothed by that reaction or just kind of, you know, pulling my hair out by that reaction, because part of me is like, wow, I'm so glad there's people who already think it that way naturally. But the other part of me is like, I want that kind of, you know, visceral response with me of like, isn't this so exciting? Because for me, it was a revelation.
Yeah, sometimes it feels with the way that my wife dotes on me about this because of just providing me the space to pursue this path that I'm on, that I just feel that sometimes it's a yes, dear, and she pats me on the back and sends me on my way. I don't know if you ever watched the movie The Princess Bride.
Oh, one of my favorites.
I feel like the king in the scene where Buttercup kisses him. And she's like, now I'm going to go back to my room and kill myself. And he's just like, she kissed me.
She kissed me.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a little pat on the back. Yes, catch up at your own speed, honey. We're already here waiting for you.
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
But again, that's why, even though we both have these analytical minds, she and I come from it from different perspectives, and that's where we're at. But it's also, my wife is 10 years older than I am, so she has a different generational experience in many ways. And it's interesting when we talk about food and these different things, and she's like, I grew up in the 70s. We didn't have a lot of this stuff that you had as a kid. I'm very much a child of technology. I've been exposed to the internet and all these things for years, and my first degree is in computer science.
Aha.
I sit here with all this technology going, well, this is kind of like my gift to the world, is to use these things, connect with people.
Yeah.
But I'm thankful. I mean, as you say, when you came to the Possibility Alliance and Stillwater Sanctuary, they were already on the ground ahead of where you were in your mind.
Yes.
And that's even when I talk with you or with Ethan, I look at all this, I feel like there's all this space that I have to make up. But at the same time, you're providing a different model for someone such as myself who has already started down this road. And the investments that I'm making in my own life provide a model for people who haven't even started.
Right. And I love how you use the word analytical. I feel very kinship with you because I consider myself a recovering left brainer at this point. It's kind of what I'd say, because I flew through school, no problem at all. It was a good time. And, you know, mathematics in particular, I totally loved. My left brain is very large and very excited and titillated by how education is presented to us. And I also realized that it didn't actually serve me all that well to engage in the world in a way that was meaningful and valuable in a holistic sense, and that there's just a lot more to it than that. And I saw my other classmates suffering at the same time. They didn't catch it like I did. So I just like the phrase I heard out in the West Coast last year, but the recovering left brainer idea that, yes, there was easy success in the world for us left brainers, but there's something much more valuable than success.
And that's kind of a place that I've come to, and I think we'll touch on this some more as we start to talk about these alternative models of education, is that I didn't really come to rediscover creativity until my oldest daughter did a lot of art in high school before she left to go to the Marine Corps. Now she's learning languages, which is very different from where she was, but she saw herself as a scientist and things, but then she would sit there, and within a period of 2 years, she went from barely doing like stick figures to photorealistic drawing just because of that passion that she had. And that kind of rekindled that fire that my wife and I both had for art. And now that she's left, my wife and I, with our youngest, who are 3 and 5 now, we're sitting down and doing collages with them. Or it's, well, what do you want to do tonight? Well, we want to do paper dolls. And my wife and I will sit down with scissors and cut out different dolls and the clothes for them, and then our children will color them and create them and craft with them. There's something about that embodiment of skill with the hands, and how working with my children with scissors and crayons and pencils is making my design work better because I'm more creative, that I'm not just doing the analysis, but it's like, okay, well, let's see, what if we stuff a bunch of trees around this house here? What is that going to look like if I draw this? And I can't say that my trees are much more than stick trees with like a cloud for the canopy, but I'm watching that progress and that embodiment of skill.
You know, Scott, I love that story, and it brings up one for me of creativity and kind of my own pursuit, my loss and pursuit of that. And that was a few years after I graduated from college. I really felt a call to not study music, but just to be able to produce music. That's always been a passion of mine. And I just felt like, okay, I'll take 2 years off and just really focus on bringing music into my life and to see if it's, you know, a worthwhile venture, to see if it's a talent or a skill that I have, if it's something of value to the world, just to see. But what I did was I was so used to the educational model that we have, which is there's a certain way to learn something, and it's modeled over and over again by our educational system. And I didn't realize how ingrained in me it was until I had this desire come out of me, right? A very clear, like, yearning from my soul. And then my left brain interpreted that as, oh, you want to study music. Okay, great. So here's how we'll study music. So we'll get a book, you know, and we'll like learn about the history of Western, you know, music. And then we'll learn music theory. And then we'll go find a piano room somewhere, a piano, and we'll learn all the scales and modes and all that stuff. And we'll practice every day. And this kind of rigorous analytical approach, which I did. And I did that for 9 months, completely focused and doing all these things and laying out my own schedule, because I was like, I don't need to pay somebody to tell me how to do that. I can do that myself. And so I started doing that, and I burned myself out. And I realized something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. So I took a break and went off and did something else. And looking back, I began to realize that what I had done wrong was that it was a calling from my spirit and from my soul to access the creative elements of myself and to learn a new language, to be able to speak in a way that I hadn't been able to speak before. But instead, I tried to like cram it in through my left brain. If I were to do it again, what I mean to say is I would have started with my passion. I would have said, what songs do I love? And I'm just going to learn to play them and be led by that into some place that I don't control or don't understand, and then just to see what would have unfolded. The path would have happened. I know that it would have, because I've seen that to be true now. But instead, I said, well, I'll just create a syllabus for myself and then follow the syllabus rigorously, like a normal schedule. I'll show up to quote-unquote class every day, and it just killed it for me. And I actually, that reflects back, this is making all these connections for me that I've never really connected before. It was fun. But I had a gap in between two classes my junior year of college. I was lying on this bench somewhere, and this leaf from a tree was hanging down right over in front of me, and the sun was coming through it. I could really clearly see the leaf and all of its cell structures, you know, and just kind of the intricacies and intimacies of this leaf as it was sitting there. And I just had this moment of like, wow, the wonder of life was kind of filling me. And I was like, I would love to learn about more about like this leaf and this tree. And then my next thought was, well, maybe I should just take a class on biology or botany or something. And then my next thought was, no, because if I do that, that'll just kill any love or wonder that I'm having right now for this plant and this tree. And that was kind of the end of it. I never even pursued it any further from that. But my intuition came up and I was like, something's happening in the classroom. And more than anything else, the thing that's happening in the classroom is it's cutting me off from my creativity and killing any expression of soul that I have to like actually pursue something in a way that's authentic to its own expression and my dialectic and relationship to it.
I laugh not at the story that you tell, but from the joy within myself because of some of the roads that I've gone down. And as I mentioned before we started the interview, and my listeners who have heard the show know that it took me a long time to get from the place where I graduated high school at 16 in 96 and went directly to the university, but I had always been a very rigorous student. It was always book learning. It was always hierarchy and structure. And there was something about the university setting and being set free that broke that model for me. And I struggled in the university the first time to complete, and I wound up actually dropping out after a number of years.
Good for you.
Well, it's a strange place to be because then I went through, after I left my career, became a stay-at-home dad for a number of years, and then was looking to return to work. But I met with someone who just kind of helps people talk through what they want to do with their career. And that person said, well, you know, you just need to get your undergrad out of the way because of the doors that opens. Because it sounds like where you are, to get these other doors open, a graduate degree would be really helpful for you. And this is where I kind of, I'll lay out some of this of my story, if you will, to lead into this conversation about education. So I went back to my original university, and I had enough credits there that I was able to get out with an associate's in computer science, and then use that to go to an online state school just to get a general, I think it's a liberal arts degree, to get that bachelor's out of the way. And then I found the graduate program that I'm currently enrolled in, which is Parks and Resources and Environmental Education. And this long kind of contextual story to get us here is that a lot of the conversation that we're having regarding environmental education is that all education is environmental education because it's a holistic approach to how we should be handling teaching. That we need to kind of break down this teacher-student paradigm, even in the public schools with young children, to give them a sense of place, to provide them this kind of like common knowledge or core knowledge within the first couple of years, like say kindergarten through the sixth grade. But then after that is when we open up and we use that core knowledge to provide them the space to find a calling rather than a career. This piece within them that has value that they will become lifelong learners with. And that comes from the work of, if you've ever read like David Orr or David Sobel.
For sure. Absolutely.
And this is one of the things that I'm coming to, that this educational approach that I'm finding is that because I don't like linear hierarchies, I understand a need for a pyramid in some ways, but that pyramid, that pyramidal structure, is that the way that I want to say that? That rather than having this pyramid with these very sharp sides, that the slope should be just enough that you might notice it, in order to give some structure, but not so high that it puts any individual on a pedestal, and whoever might be a part of this structure, that anyone could be standing in that place at any time, depending on what they're transferring to the people who they're involved with. Anyway, I'm still trying to figure out the way to properly discuss this in a meaningful way, but it is, just for me, is reducing that height and making it a more open conversation. But it's, as you said earlier about debt and the cost of education for me to get through that associate's and a bachelor's degree, I think the total cost over a number of years was like $60,000. And now, because of some of the doors that were closed to me in regular academia, you know, I would make phone calls to people and go, "Hi, can I talk to you about some things?" And they're like, "Oh, well, what's your background?" I'm just a guy. No, I don't really think that you know enough about this material to have a cogent conversation with me. I'm sorry. Or some folks who I've had as guests on the show. It's taken me 5 or 6 phone calls over a period of months to be able to convince them that I actually care enough about their position to have them come speak with me. Yet I find now that I call somebody, go, "Hi, I'm a graduate student in environmental education. I want to talk to your specialty." Like, that's all I have to say. They don't care what my show is. They don't care about anything else. They're like, "Oh, you're a student. You have an interest in what I'm doing here. Let's talk." And for me, that's really frustrating for people who want to find alternatives in this ingrained structure. And it's like, for me, in this path that I'm on, I'm already looking at pursuing some kind of doctoral level work because of the doors that that opens. When you go into a conference, you go into a lecture, and you're introduced as Dr. So-and-so. Or you give someone a card that, for me, would be, you know, Scott Mann, comma, PhD or EDD. And your expertise is automatic. It's not years and years of books published and everything else. It's hard for me as a person to look at it and go, "Hey, here are some letters after somebody's name, and that's what makes them an expert." And it's, really? Is that what we've come to value so much in our society? What about the 10 or 15 years that someone's built putting together a sustainable farm, or a farmer who's learning how to pasture poultry and pork in a rotational grazing system, and what that means for them and how that changes their business?
Yeah, and I think there comes a crucial point when you have to decide whether you're going to be, and I don't say this is a judgment either way, but whether you're going to be a reformist or a revolutionary. And a reformist is someone who works from the inside to attempt to change the inertia and the structure of the system in which you're a part of. And then the revolutionary is going to attempt to create something on the outside, to create something different, to kind of like have, again, that like dialogue with the existing thing. And it's a choice, you know, like you're going to choose whether you're going to, there is that moment for you and you chose that, you know, which is like, okay, if I choose to do this and take on this debt, then it will open certain doors for me, which will lead me down a path. And the question is that the path that I want? And there's all kinds of seductions along the way to kind of pull us down that way, both on the inside and the outside. And that whatever choice we make, there's going to be battles that we're going to have to take on. It's just the nature of the battles that we're choosing to take and the nature of the path that we want to walk. But I mean, it brings up two things for me, which is that, one, we feel in our educational process that people are the experts on their own experience, like the Miles Horton model and the Highlander Folk School. People are the experts on their own experience. And so we want to create an atmosphere where all of that experience and wisdom is honored, not just one person who happens to be at the front of the classroom. You know, we want to create an experience where there's a community engaging in a communal process, moving into the unknown together and supporting each other, instead of one person disseminating information that they feel like is important, that's free of context from the world, has no relevance necessarily to what else is happening, to either to you or to the world at large. And then the other piece that you said that really sparked something in me is vocation. You know, the idea that what we want to do, our most important role when it comes to education, is to help somebody find what their greatest passion is and where that meets the world's greatest needs. Both of those together, one or the other, is not going to work. If you're just serving the world's greatest needs and you're not on fire when you're doing it, you're going to burn out. And then you're creating a poor model for people around you. But if you're following your greatest passion without any sort of concern or awareness of the context of the world, you're probably blazing a massive trail of destruction all around you that you're completely unaware of, unfortunately, given the system that we live in today. And so how do we bring both of those two together in a way that, you know, again, it's this idea of right livelihood, that has kind of restraint when it comes to working with the world? Because when we realize what I would call in an ideal form, a properly educated person, I'm using that in quotes, from my vision, not from the system's vision, that kind of person I think would be really well trained or well regarded in three aspects. And one of them is understanding that we have the power to destroy living systems as humans. but we don't have the power to fully understand and comprehend them. They're part of a living mystery. And because that's true, there has to be restraint in how we engage living systems in the world. There has to be a fundamental humility in our relationship to those things. And that's anathema to the American way of life. You know, Americans don't want taboos and they don't want limits. That's the one thing they don't want. And that's the one thing that we need. And Bill Mollison talks about this. Permaculture is an ethical design science. It's a design science based on ethics. That has nothing to do with our left brain. It has to do with right engagement with the world based on certain things that we simply cannot do because there's things that we cannot know. And so a properly educated person, in my personal point of view, would be able to operate humility and restraint and engagement with the world and to understand what things that we can do that will feed all of life and what things we should never do or we should only do very, very rarely.
Your comment about reformer versus revolutionary is funny to me because I had a friend ask me once if I was a revolutionary, and I said, I don't know if that's the R word that I would use for that. What you're speaking to is a lot of what I'm coming to on this formal path of education is that analytical model isn't the only one that we need to use because there's a lot that comes from the creative side in order to tell a holistic story that matters.
Right.
That we can use the reductionist science to have a knowledge of the world and the way that it operates. But if we're going to care about that information and what happens in the world and tell the stories that matter, we have to use emotions and feeling in it. It's not one or the other, that it's both, that we can do this very small-scale micro stuff with our science and our research, but let's use these big macro pieces to pull it all together and make it something that matters to every person who's engaged.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're a good permaculture designer, the first thing you're going to do, in my personal opinion, is you're going to walk onto the land, you know, and you're going to get an intuitive hit of what's going on. You know, you're reading the landscape, and of course there's ways of analytically learning about reading the landscape that are going to inform you. You take time to learn about what weeds and plants are there, and it's going to tell you what's going on with the soils and what's happening with the mineral cycles and all of this stuff. But after a while, you leave that analytical left brain behind for a while, and you can just walk onto a site and you can get a sense of the place. And not only a sense of the place, but then you can be drawn. You know, you kind of walk and flow through, and all of a sudden, this happens to me all the time, I'll end up at the power spot. You know, there's not only one necessarily, but I'll end up at the place that feels good. Like, oh, this is a nice spot. You know, like, this is a great thing. Something is happening here that's working, you know. And then just keep on, again, walking around and moving and just get an intuitive sense of the place. What is the land asking for? What's possible here? You know, and then the next thing you're going to do is to go talk to whoever the landowners are or whoever the stakeholders are and then get a sense of what are the human goals here. You know, like there's always two clients. You know, there's always the land and then there's the humans. And the humans are also going to have these wants and needs, basic desires and all this. And as an interviewer, as someone who is kind of like helping match these two things up, I don't want to just hear, oh, I want a gazebo, you know, or something like that. Like, I want to get down to the fundamental needs of what's happening to this person. You know, like, what are the desires that are coming out of you and why are they there? What are your needs? You know, let's skip strategies for a second. You know, like, let's skip form and go to function here. You know, like, what are the functionalities that you're looking for and why? And usually when you start going there, all of a sudden you run into problems with the marriage, you know, and like, oh, I'm not following my life path because you're starting to get down to, like, what's at your soul level? What's really alive in you? Because you're projecting a lot of those things onto your land. Oh, I really want some sort of gazebo because I need a place to retreat because my life is really chaotic right now and I just need a place of silence. Okay, wow, maybe we should actually look at your social structure of your life and begin to rethink some of that because it sounds like your life is so fragmented right now and your soul is so splintered that you don't have time just to have 20 minutes by yourself to bring it all together in a way that allows you to flow from a sense of groundedness. And this goes back again to like what I would call like a well-educated person, in my personal view, would have three things. I just talked about the first one, which is kind of how to engage with the world, and I would call that landscape literacy. And David Orr said that we're in an age of landscape illiteracy. Some kind of information in an information-rich world that we're in right now is proliferate and proliferating, and it's easily accessible. But there's other kinds of information or knowledge, I would say, that's being lost. And so it's a misunderstanding and a misread of our culture, I think, to say that there's more information available now than there ever was. I 100% disagree with that statement because there's a kind of information, and I think the most important kind of information, that can't be written down. There, we had somebody come and speak to us a few weeks ago. His name's Dominic Barter. He pioneered the restorative circles movement. in the favelas of Brazil, 17 years going into extreme conflict in some of the most violent places on earth, and he created a system that allows conflict to be engaged and transformed in a way that brings the community together, and it works. And he came to teach our community more about that. And I was completely transformed by what he brought. But what he brought was his presence. It wasn't a method, and it wasn't a strategy. It was an intuitive understanding through his own experience of his life. And he was able to speak with the authority of the wisdom of his own experience that there's something valuable in conflict. There's information that's really important in there that is meaningful to every party in that conflict. And if we can move into it instead of running away from it, which I personally was taught to do, to be scared of conflict and to run away from it, if we can move into it and handle it with honor and integrity and respect and groundedness and come to the seed that's there, there's something powerful for all of us. But he modeled it. He wasn't talking about it, and he wasn't giving us some sort of strategy that could be written down. And I had this personal response. I thought, wow, I really want to write down what this guy's saying and pass it on to other people so that they can learn what this guy's talking about. But then I realized if I wrote down what he was saying, because I thought about, well, this is what I'd write down. And then I looked at what I wrote down, and I was like, it's missing the whole point. It's actually missing. It's missing the most valuable piece of information that's in this exchange, and that is the presence that he has and his ability to model it. And I began to realize the most valuable things that I've experienced in my life were impossible to write down, which means they aren't found in books and they're not found on screens. And so there's a really valuable kind of knowledge that's being lost. And it's kind of scary, I think. And that kind of knowledge is what happens in an authentic relationship with yourself and with others and with the land that you gain by an intuitive sense, not by an analytical sense. And that era, which we're in right now, of landscape illiteracy, I think is what's causing a lot of the ecological devastation and destruction that we have, because people are under the assumption that they can just get whatever information that they need and they can be wherever they need to be. And so place doesn't matter, but it's just not true. And I got a little off topic, but...
From the topic of education, I don't think that you really went too far afield, because a lot of the things that it speaks to, and there's some stories that I tell repeatedly because they're part of my own existence, and I'm sure that some of my listeners are tired of hearing them. But it was, for me, there are two pieces to this, and it's that I was raised by my parents because of some of the struggles that they went through, both of them. My mother grew up very, very poor, and my father didn't grow up poor, but he grew up with a post-depression mindset because he was the son of a farmer, but his grandfather had lost the farm during the Depression. And my grandfather, my father's father, never wanted to see that happen again. So my grandfather would farm for 8 hours a day, and then he was out building houses, you know, himself and a couple of people, my father's oldest brother, and then my father, and my father was later, because they wanted to make sure that there was always money available, and that never happened again.
Yeah.
And that kind of instilled in my father a sense that then he was not going to be a farmer because there wasn't money in it in the same way that there was in the trade. So my grandfather taught my father to have a trade.
I completely agree with you. That's funny, your story, because I completely resonate. My grandparents were sharecroppers in Arkansas. They almost died during the Depression. And they did everything that they could to get off the farm. I mean, they wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. And so their salvation was a factory job. So my grandfather moved from the farm up to St. Louis to work in a factory. And that was saving grace that they were able to get out of there. And so then my mom, their daughter, worked her way through school, the first female or woman in their family to be educated, and has made herself, if there is such a thing, a self-made woman, like to become successful in our world and times. And, you know, she wants me to be like safe and secure, you know, and my grandmother, of course, does too. And my grandma in particular thinks I'm crazy. Because, you know, I mean, she's angry with me and just really doesn't understand. Like, she's like, she hates the farm. Like, it is just, it represents destitution to her. And the fact that I would be back on a farm with as much success as was promised to me and how good I did at school, like, to be back here is completely impossible for her to understand. And, you know, tricky for my mom, too, for sure. There's so rich what you just brought up, because there's that piece, but then of course that brings up the conflict piece, you know, and just what you said is like when there's something raw on the table, all of a sudden our analytical minds are lost, because that's the one thing, if there is one thing, that they're completely untrained to handle. You know, and so being an analytical left-brainer myself, like I realized that I had no skills when it came to engaging with conflict in a way that was meaningful and powerful. And if somebody came to me that was really, and they were really charged, especially if it was about something that I had done, it would always end up being an equal and opposite reaction. And I mean a reaction very particularly. It wasn't a response. It was a reaction. I felt like I had no control. They would come at me, and I just had this kind of built-in response from whatever I had intuited from our culture and from my family and whatever, of just like, conflict was scary. I didn't know how to deal with it. I run away from it. And if there's no way to run away from it, then I turn around and push back in whatever way that I can come up with to kind of diffuse their argument or something. And it never felt good, and it never went well. And one of the things that I learned here, and one of the things that we focus on in our education, is, are these skills? Like, if there's so many areas where our modern education is lacking, and one of them is right relationship with each other, and how do you engage each other well, especially when there's conflict? Because obviously, if there's not conflict, it's very easy to be in right relationship with each other. If you love each other and everything's fine, there's nothing you need to learn. But it's when you're in conflict, and when there's diversity, and that diversity starts to begin to grind with each other, we need to practice this. We need to learn how to do this. And one of the things that we learn here is nonviolent communication. And the first time that I kind of just started talking with people about it and started reading about it, I had the same feeling I had when I learned about permaculture, which is, why wasn't I taught this in third grade? This would have been so helpful. And it's so easy to just, it gave me a literacy, a kind of literacy that I didn't have about my own feelings and my own needs. And just to be able to express that. And all of a sudden, this was completely revolutionary in my life. It completely changed my life. I realized that if somebody's coming to me and they're angry, it has nothing to do with me. Like, it's just them. That doesn't mean that maybe I didn't do something that I need to atone for. That doesn't mean that. But it does mean that their reaction is their reaction. It has nothing to do with me. And that is totally freeing. This was news for me. Maybe everyone else already knows this. But for me, what it allowed me to do was to not react. It allowed me to just be grounded in my own peace and my own patience, and to just listen to what the person had to say and their reaction, and then to respond in the way that I felt like was authentic in the moment. And that response almost always is with empathy and understanding that they're in pain right now for some reason. Almost always, it has something not necessarily to do with what I did, but something that they're perceiving is going on, which isn't necessarily true, or a past pain that they're bringing up. And if I can just sit there and empathize with them and really kind of hear where they're at, then it'll diffuse itself. And then we can kind of get to the meat of it, like what needs for you aren't being met and how can I meet those better for you? You know, and then all of a sudden we're closer now. We have a closer relationship now than we did before because we are able to engage something that I'm sure has gone so poorly so many times in the past for that person and for me. And all of a sudden we begin to trust each other more too. And I feel like this is fundamental to education. Like this is what we should be learning, how to be in right relationship with each other. You know, and what I see, and I totally agree with you, if there's two things, maybe three, but if there's two things that I want people to learn out of a real education, what I would call a real education, one is what I've already said, landscape literacy, and the other one is the ability to engage with people in right relationship, to be able to handle conflict and to speak their emotional life in a way that's responsible and honest and vulnerable, to be able to engage with people with openness. And that openness comes from a groundedness in ourselves to know that whatever somebody says has nothing to do about us and can't hurt us. That idea that like sticks and stones, words may never hurt me, and then other people say that's not true, words can't hurt. Well, I actually disagree with that. I think if we can see where words are coming from and we can see that somebody's only saying, you know, either please or thank you, like please help me with this need that I have, or thank you so much for helping me meet a need. If one of those two things are going on, it allows us to be open all the time. There's nothing we need to guard inside of ourselves or to hide because it's safe. We can carry that safety around us. But what I see our modern education system doing is the opposite of both of those. People feel like they can engage in the world without limits at all and extract whatever they want to, and people are completely guarded and don't understand how to engage with people and are scared when conflict comes up. And I feel like this is why our culture is falling apart.
You just highlighted so many different points that I want to respond to. One quick question. When you refer to nonviolent communication, are you looking at the work of Marshall Rosenberg?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. He's one that I recommend. It was, I forget who I talked to who brought me to nonviolent communication, but between that and reading Don Miguel Ruiz?
Yeah. Four Agreements?
Yeah, the Four Agreements. It's like between that simple list of the Four Agreements and the basic strategies that Marshall Rosenberg lays out for nonviolent communication, between those two, they really open the door to being able to talk to just about anyone?
Oh, yeah. If you can put those two things into practice, your life will completely change, guaranteed.
Very much so. I find the two of them to be very good. Now, granted, I'm not very good about not making assumptions or not taking anything personally because
or being impeccable with your word. How hard is that?
I find that I'm getting better with that the more that I cut out, if you will, a lot of the distractions and a lot of the crap from my life.
Absolutely.
And for me, that's things like television and pop culture. And I mean, you're living much further down this road than I am. But as I pull away these different pieces that don't add to who I am as a person in my life, it's a lot easier to be honest with myself and impeccable with my word because I'm not drawn away from things.
I totally agree with you.
And that was Adam Campbell. In this conversation, we talk about being open and honest and nonviolent in the way we communicate. That reminds me of the talk with Dave Jackie and that idea that vulnerability is strength. If we want to cut through all the dross, or as I said in this episode, crap, of our lives, then we need to be real with ourselves and in our dealings with others. I think that learning how to communicate better plays a big role in that. So to complement this interview, I'm setting up other talks with folks from the nonviolent communication movement, including Dominic Barter. In the meantime, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend checking out Nonviolent Communication by Dr. Marshall Rosenberg. It's not a long or difficult read, and you may find it transformational in your ability to communicate with others, both in being able to thank them for helping you and being better able to express your own needs. Please let me know if I can help you in any way on your journey. Send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or give me a call, 717-827-6266. You can also follow the show on Facebook, facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or connect with me on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. Next up is a short episode with Peter McCoy, where he introduces us to his ideas and his project entitled Radical Mycology. Then I take a week off before returning for the last episode of 2013, a recap and look forward. If you want to share this show with others, that one will serve as a good primer for what to explore as well as what to expect. And then the first interview of 2014 is going to be Arthur Haynes. He returns to talk more about wild foods. To you all in this holiday season, may you have a wonderful time with your friends and family. Until we meet again, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit illegal. The Permaculture Podcast is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Feel free to share it. Just let people know where you got it from and don't change or sell it.